The United States has stumbled and backed up into our third Asian war in 25 years. We first came into Southeast Asia as part of our military operation against the Japanese. At the end of the Second World War, we withdrew. The United States has never had vital political or economic or military interests in this faraway part of the world. The Cold War, however, brought us back to Southeast Asia. A nationalist front was organized in Vietnam and Indochina at the end of the Second World War for the purpose of driving out the French colonial regime. Communists took a major role in this National Liberation Front. And Secretary of State John Foster Dulles, in 1953, noticing the presence of these communists and concerned that the French were falling into the tragedy of Dien Bien Phu and ultimate defeat, was eager that the United States then involve itself militarily and bail out the French. His rationalization in 1953 was the now familiar domino theory. It remains the only expressed justification of the United States' commitment till this day. According to this domino theory, any nation which is communist subverts and weakens the nations around its borders. Therefore, a ring must be drawn around the Sino-Soviet bloc, Russia, China, and its satellites, and the free world must be prepared to abort invasion or insurgency or subversion wherever these may appear. Dulles reasoned that if Indochina were to go communistic, Burma, Malaysia, and the Philippines would be seriously threatened. And in testimony before a congressional committee last week, Secretary McNamara, repeated this justification, almost word for word, as the rationale and reason of our current policies. Now, on the surface of it, the domino theory seems simple and self-evident. Unfortunately, it is not so. It commits us to global military intervention. Wherever a revolution, royals and communists are found among the revolutionaries, we must intrude against them to stabilize the government. We simply lack the wherewithal, the military power, to be the stability of governments in Asia and Africa and Latin America, wherever our world is in tumult and confusion. Then, too, this domino theory puts us in opposition to our own age. We become the support, the bayonet and the bazookas and the tanks and the military aid and the economic aid of the past, of the governments of the privileged, of the hated, of the governments of the few who have foisted for years and decades and yea the centuries upon the peasants and the laborers and the illiterate, all those who now clamor for their place in the sun. The longer that we support these toppling regimes, the more violent becomes the revolution, and the more dominant the place of disciplined communist cadres in the revolutionary force. In a strange, paradoxic way, our own determination to stabilize the non-communist or anti-communist governments has contributed to the communist subversion of many a nation. And so it is, following this domino theory, that we have supported the Batistas and the Chambes, and in Vietnam, the Ngo Diems. And it has not availed us. In any case, in 1953, Mr. Dulles was not able to affect his policy. Public opinion would have none of it. We had just extricated ourselves from the deep Korean mud, and we were not about to re-involve ourselves in another jungle land in Asia. Russia, and Great Britain effected a hard-nosed and realistic compromise to the Indo-Chinese to the Indo-Chinese failure in the Geneva Conference of 1954. Laos was federated, Cambodia was freed, and Vietnam was divided between a largely communist-controlled government in Hanoi and an anti-communist government in control in Saigon. Mr. Dulles ostentatiously would have nothing to do with this Geneva conference. He had lost the skirmish, but he would not be sullied with such negotiation. Yet he was determined that though he had lost the skirmish, he would not lose his position. South Vietnam was to be the anti-communist state, the showcase of freedom in Southeast Asia. He created the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization, and he threw the paper guarantees of this treaty organization, the guarantee of our own concern, around the government of Ngo Diem. He saw to it that large amounts of American foreign aid were poured into this country. Its prosperity, its freedom, was to shine against the bleakness of the communist world, to show to the Asians the advantages of belonging to the freedom side. From 1954 to 1959, progress of an economic order did take place in South Vietnam. And much was made in our press and by our various administrations of the so-called South Vietnamese success story. South Vietnam was our living example of the virtue of freedom, of the virtue of belonging with the West. But all that our aid really served to do was to mask for the moment the bitterness and the restlessness of a troubled and divided people. For those who ruled in Saigon had not been popularly elected. They had been left there. They had taken over in a power vacuum. They were our people, representatives of the Mandarin class, of the privileged few who had always enjoyed the advantages, the tax farming of Southeast Asia. Ngo Diem, the chosen leader, was an autocrat. The press was censored. Political opponents were jailed. Students were curbed. The Buddhists were repressed, even though they were the majority. And the tribes people and the hills people who control 60 to 70% of the land of South Vietnam and who have always been held apart and as racially inferior by the lowlanders of the nation continued to long for a freer and a better day. By 1959, restlessness, bitterness had broken out in revolt. The Viet Cong, the revolutionaries, were in the field. Little by little, bit by bit, our economic aid became military aid. Our foreign aid advisors became military observers. Little by little, the support of the Saigon regime became a first priority of our foreign policy. By 1961, the situation had deteriorated to the point where radical remedies were necessary. A new policy was announced. We would establish iron-walled hamlets as strategic points throughout the area and a scientific pacification of the country would be achieved. We were told much about the way in which the British had pacified Malaysia. This was to be the example. President Kennedy ordered 20,000 American men of a special force into South Vietnam to organize and to effect this pacification, this solution. And we were promised, you will recall, that they would be home in 6 months. Victory was easy and it would soon be ours. 6 months became a year, and a year became two. Deterioration became defeat, and the bombings took place not in isolated hamlets, but in the heart of Saigon. And soon it became evident that it was our own military billets and our own military airfields who suffered, who were the subjects, the focus of these attacks. And now the final indignity has been added in this whole bloody mess. For now we have the great powers of the world have been drawn into it. We have, what is the word, escalated the war? It's a nice way of saying that we have followed the old archaic law of an eye for an eye. We have decided to bomb north of the 17th parallel. We have decided to interdict lines in Laos and Cambodia. We have escalated the war. And the war has escalated on us. And with the decisions of President Johnson these past months, little by little, our action in South Vietnam drags us to the brink. Now, one thing is true. Our South Vietnamese commitment has never been popular, yet it has been taken by men of both parties. It is not a partisan issue. And this itself is surprising. For even as our presidents committed us to economic aid and to military aid and then into military action, they tried to back and to fill and to qualify. None has been happy with what he was ordered to do and what he ordered to do. None has been happy. We have stumbled backward somehow into this war. Never has a war in American history been so little debated or understood by the American people. Never has a government, and this goes back for the last 12 years, never has a government been so unwilling to allow a nation to debate priorities, to suggest alternatives, and to arrive at a consensus. There has been, unfortunately, a great deal of news management and even of downright deceit, which emanates from Washington in all of this. It has been unnecessary. It is ugly, yet has been practiced. Just 2 years ago, the head of our United States Information Agency, Mr. Karl Rowan, said some very foolish things about what he called the right of the people not to know in an undeclared war. For a long time, the administration tried to deny that Diem was anything but the very, very model of a modern Asian Democrat. For a long time, we were fed pabulum. We were told all would be well. This plan or another, this military operation or another, would quickly solve the issue. And so when Americans meet today, when you and I discuss Vietnam, that we have been involved in this faraway land for 12 years, the question we ask each other is the elementary, the basic question. Why are we there? Why are we in Vietnam in the first place? Our government says, we want to negotiate. People now, give us alternatives. Our government has not even told us the rationale for this entire action. Why are we in South Vietnam? Well, self-preservation is a legitimate undertaking of national policy. Are we in South Vietnam to preserve the nation? In May of last year, Secretary McNamara, in a speech which was subsequently released by the State Department as an authoritative definition of our policy, made the following categorical statement. Our national interests do not require that Vietnam serve as a Western base or as a member of the Western alliance. A few North Vietnamese PT boats and a puny and archaic air force do not threaten our shipping lanes or our shorelines. Self-preservation is not the issue in South Vietnam. What is? Several years ago, in a speech before the Economic Club of Detroit, Undersecretary of State Ball gave the usual and familiar explanation for our involvement. Vietnam, he said, is one of the world's danger spots where valiant people are struggling to defend their freedom. We Americans are assisting them in their struggle. America has committed its force to protect the freedom of a weak people, but a valiant people, far across the world from insurgency and subversion. So reads the text. Now, the explanation of the text is this. Mr. Ho Chi Minh, head of the North Vietnamese, was never happy with the partition of Indochina. He has proclaimed the reunification of Vietnam as a first order of business for his government, much as our own beloved West German ally has proclaimed the reunification of Germany as its first order of business. He's eager for the power, and there are economic reasons too. The North has the industry, the South is the rice land. The workers of the North need the excess food production of the South in order to balance out the economy, to make it viable. And beginning in about 1959, Mr. Ho Chi Minh determined to speed up the reunification of South Vietnam with his own nation, and he began to permit the passage of materiel and of manpower through jungle trails to the Viet Cong. Apparently, he at first hoped that the Saigon government would fall of its own weight. It was not a popularly elected government. He had felt that it would soon fall in one of those endemic revolutions which sweep over this part of the world. Our aids shorted up, it did not fall. And so Ho Chi Minh resorted to this insurgency, as it is now called, this guerrilla action. And they began to terrorize the countryside, and there was murder, and there was ravage, and there was brutality of an unconscionable order. And matters went from bad to worse. The Saigon government was not able to defend its hamlets, its farmers, its people, and it asked for our help. And we who have so much were willing to give of our power. And we are giving still. Vietnam is one of the world's danger spots, so goes our philosophy, where valiant people are struggling to defend their freedom. We Americans are assisting them in their struggle. On first reading and on the surface, Secretary Ball's argument, the argument of our State Department, seems patently clear and true. And there is truth to it. North Vietnam has been active in supplying men and materiel to the Viet Cong. Even though some of us unfortunately have come to suspect all that is said in Washington in this issue, we cannot suspect the definite statements made by the International Controls Commission, which was set up by the Geneva Conference in 1954. A commission of neutral nations headed by an Indian general, who in 1962 brought out a report which specifically accused the North Vietnamese of interfering and meddling in South Vietnam away from their own borders. The proof is there. Our case seems to be made. But unfortunately, life does not fit neatly into these phrases. There is insurgency. There is subversion. There is a communist plot in South Vietnam. But all of this is inextricably bound up in a local, murderous, brutal civil war. The Viet Cong receive North Vietnamese arms. No one knows the percentage of North Vietnamese personnel in the Viet Cong, or if they know it has not been released. But this much is certain. The Viet Cong took to the field first. They represent a South Vietnamese revolt. The revolt of the masses against the privileged. The revolt of the peasant against the tax farmer. The revolt of the student against the censor. The result of opposition dissidents against the warlords. The revolt of the hill peoples against those who looked down upon them racially and hated them. The countryside has provided information and men and support and hiding and safeguard and security. All that a guerrilla band needs to operate. We tried for a long time to deny this truth. And then those brilliant funereal pyres in which the Buddhist monks suicided, lighting kerosene on their saffron robes, highlighted what can no longer be denied. And then we began to hear the chant of students dancing and singing their protest in the street. And then we began to ask ourselves, how is it that northern infiltrators can receive so much support in a country such as South Vietnam? And remember this, too, that the division of Vietnam is not a new thing. In the 18th and 19th centuries, until France took over this part of the world, there was a Berlin Wall across the narrow middle of Vietnam, within miles of today's demarcation line. And for over two centuries, Hanoi and Saigon were separate governments, ruled independently, each with its own narrow and selfish political ends. Fortunately for us, then, we became involved in a nation which was not only suffering attack from without, but which was suffering the death throes of unrest and of revolution within. Indeed, no one as yet knows whether it was the existence of the Viet Cong which led to the North Vietnamese action, or whether the North Vietnamese brought the Viet Cong first into the field by promises of support and aid. In any case, we have interfered in a local civil war. We have interfered in a nation where the government no longer has the respect, is no longer responsible to the popular will, it has never been, and where the government cannot marshal the vigor, the wealth, the will of its people to fight for freedom. I have no way of knowing whether the Vietnamese are valiant or not. There are heroes and cowards in all nations, but no nation is valiant. No nation willingly sacrifices its young men in battle unless its will is united for some conceived holy purpose. The South Vietnamese are not united. The knives and the guns are turned brother against brother. It's a bitter, ugly, futile piece of business. And as long as this internecine squabble, as long as this modern revolution, as long as this expression of national unrest continues, all the Pentagon's helicopters and all the Pentagon's men will not put the South Vietnamese government together again. Well, how did we get into this mess? Three theories have been offered. I reject the first. First theory holds that we have been manipulated into our involvement in Southeast Asia by men in Washington, in the military, in high places, who are determined that a preventive war shall erupt before China fully controls her nuclear arsenal. All of our actions are seen as sinister and clandestine. And unfortunately, the silence of our own government gives ammunition to these men who purvey the theory of some kind of right-wing subversion. We have backed into this war. We have stumbled in it. We have not been manipulated secretly into it. The second explanation, and this offered by some of our best military minds, this explanation was suggested a dozen years ago by General MacArthur, holds that we overcommitted ourselves in Southeast Asia. There are some things that man must simply learn to live with. We cannot stay off the day of our death. We cannot stay off disease. These things are uncomfortable, but there is simply no cure. It may not be to our liking that Southeast Asia may go communist, but we lack the manpower. We lack the closeness of supply reserves to effect our ends. General MacArthur argued that we are essentially a sea power and a navy power, and that the choice of terrain in Southeast Asia precisely vitiates this superiority of ours. The existence of the Cold War limits our ability to use our nuclear arsenal, and we are forced into a man-to-man jungle combat. And for every man that we have and can put into the field and keep there,
The Asian can put 100 and 1,000, and then yet another 1,000. Senator Church, just 3 weeks ago, explained this point of view, I think, very effectively in this phrase. The elephant cannot drive the whale from the sea or the eagle from the sky. But it is also true that neither the whale nor the eagle can drive the elephant from his jungle. I accept this cold-blooded military calculation, and I believe that it is true. I believe that the United States has been overcommitted in Southeast Asia. But I ask myself, why are we there? General MacArthur was not silent. This position was printed in the public press. It was well known, and yet our presidents went ahead. Why so? The root explanation I would submit lies in this. We have not yet lost the naive belief that you can solve bread and butter problems with bayonets. We still believe that guns and tanks and foreign aid can stabilize the world and solve the complex economic and political problems of the age. And it simply cannot be done. France poured 350,000 men into Indochina. France was spending one-third of her total national budget on the Indochinese military operation, and she was not able to sustain the Emperor Bao Dai in power. Why? Because the age of royalty and of royal privilege, when men must bend their back before the royal will, is behind us. For 12 years now, we have poured our treasure into South Vietnam. Our men have been there, and our will. And we were not able to sustain Ngo Diem in power. Why? Because in Asia, the age of the Mandarin is over. Asia has moved beyond feudal times into the technological age, into the 20th century. We must somehow find ways of coming to grips with a revolutionary age and not always betting our dollars on the past, on the relic, on the fossil. There's no point simply in raking over the coals, except the vain hope that somehow we will recognize in Latin America and in Africa that we need to be allied with progress, with the new, with this century, with the underprivileged and the undernourished and the illiterate, with the mass, for all of their fumblings and for all of their stumblings and for all of their flirtations with the East. What now? Everyone seems to be agreed, insofar as anyone talks about this whole thing, that some hard choices will have to be made. But no one seems prepared to define the alternatives or to make public the choice. We need a policy. Measured retaliation is not a policy. It's after the fact. It's tardy. It's a response to someone else's initiative. It's our answer to decisions made in the heat of a jungle battle 5,000 miles from our shore. Sporadic retaliation is nothing more than the nuclear age's version of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. It's primitive. It's futile. And it's absurdly dangerous. It's futile. How will a few corpses affect the sway of battle? A few more dead will not change things. The one materiel that Asia has in oversupply is her human resource. It is an absurdly dangerous policy. It gives over the fate of this nation and of the world into the hands of semi-literate Viet Cong bandit chiefs in the mountain fastnesses of that jungle land, and into the hands of South Vietnamese generals who make their decisions by very narrow political calculation. An attack is made. Hanoi or Saigon retaliates. The attack is escalated. We shell some coastal position north of the 17th parallel, or an American special force billet is attacked in Saigon. Russia and China are forced to renew their pledges of friendship and of military support, their defensive alliances with North Vietnam and with the Viet Cong. And we are, of course, forced to do the same with whatever government for the moment exists in Saigon. Little by little, jungle decisions force the great powers of the world to their brink, to the brink. And I ask myself this. Is control of this little land of 17 million people, 5,000 miles from our shore, worth 120 or 130 million American dead? And this is precisely the estimate given by Secretary McNamara in testimony before Congress last week. The number of dead in the case of an all-out nuclear war. And Mr. Kosygin must be wrestling with the same murderous equation. And neither man and neither nation wants it, of that I am sure. How do we avoid it? We live in the era of the Cold War, where nations have commitments beyond their limited national interests. Where somehow, by some absurd quirk of national psychology, Vietnamese bullets can make the great atomic powers of the world stand face to face. I dare you not. I double dare you. Pray God it goes on. We need a policy. Our present policy is one of drift. Our present policy is one of improvisation. The President of the United States is elected to lead, but he is not led. He must bear the responsibility to effect broad policy direction. Instead, he has limited himself to narrow military decision. I know of no similar example in the long history of our nation in which, during a moment of such grave moment, a president of the United States has withheld himself for so long from taking the nation into his confidence. I am deeply troubled by this. An uninformed nation is an uneasy nation. An uneasy nation takes erratic, and oft-times cruelly wrong, decisions. The American people need to know. We need to feel that we can be trusted. We need to feel that all the alternatives have been weighed. We need to know that our lives and our tax monies are being spent in truly significant pursuit. Now, I am troubled by those who say that we will negotiate. Everyone seems to agree that we will negotiate, but that we will negotiate only that when we have arrived at a position of strength. For in my humble estimation, the hard truth is that there can be no victory in South Vietnam. Even if this Viet Cong were to be defeated, and indications are now that they have achieved at least a partial victory, but even if they were to be defeated and our men were to be secure in the seats of power in Saigon, our men would be anti-American. They would have to be. Do you recall the speeches of General Khan just 6 weeks ago? How he damned this nation and our proconsuls and all of our military might? No nation likes to take orders from another nation. No nation likes to feel beholden. No nation likes to accept responsibility for its own agony. As a military base, as a military ally, whatever happens, South Vietnam is lost to the West. I'm troubled by those who say that we will negotiate, but only from a position of strength and only on our own terms. hard truth is that we will never have our way in South Vietnam. The Viet Cong, whatever its ulterior motives, represents the revolt of the peasant against the Mandarin. It is the voice of the 20th century in arms against the age of privilege. Hard truth is that we cannot turn back the hands of the clock. And what of the argument that we have no right to turn over this nation to communist dominance? Again, there is a hard truth, and it is this, that if they will it, we cannot prevent it. We cannot impose our will against a people that will not see the light. We know, we live daily, the advantages of freedom. What advantage has freedom to a South Vietnamese except the advantage to see his village burned and the advantage to have his men die violently? Whenever negotiation comes, and negotiation will come, the hard truth is that South Vietnam will not be a good friend or a close ally of our international military objectives. And I am further troubled by those who say that to negotiate now would be to damage irreparably the American image. Isn't it time that we stop this adolescent concern with a mirror? The rulers of the world are calculating men, and they know full well that even the mammoth powers sometimes overestimate their capacity. And if a giant power must withdraw from a commitment, these calculating men are not so naive as to assume that they have been bled of all their power. Mr. Khrushchev showed us in the Cuba Missile Crisis that a great power, a gigantic power, can retreat from a position once taken. And the hard truth is, again, that for all of our missiles, for all of our might, we cannot impose our will, we cannot bull our way through. International obstinacy is the sure way in an atomic age to the fallout shelter. Somehow we must take a step back along the power road in order that we in the world can take a step or two forward along the road to a settled world order. Now, insofar as our government has made its position clear, it seems to be this: that we insist upon the surrender of the Viet Cong and the withdrawal of North Vietnamese infiltrators. And once this is achieved, we will withdraw our troops. Until then, we intend to prosecute the war with every capacity at our strength. Now, at first blush, this seems a decent proposal. The Viet Cong include infiltrators. Can we ask it to surrender? Will it surrender? China and Russia, not to speak of North Vietnam, are committed to its survival. It has tasted victory. Can it surrender? Can a band of revolutionary South Vietnamese surrender to other South Vietnamese? What of their lives? Can we ask for their surrender? Are we really prepared to ask for it? Our position would be understandable if the Viet Cong were only infiltrators. Unfortunately, most of them are Vietnamese. To require their surrender is to impose our will on a Vietnamese civil war. All our talk about strengthening the popularity of the government in Saigon admits this. Why does the government need to be strengthened? Because the people are opposed to it. And all of our talk remains just talk. Because the narrow range of choices between this general and that, between this high civil servant and that high civil servant, between this junta and that junta, all of these choices which are now ours, all of these kaleidoscopic, unpronounceable names that appear time and again, almost daily now in our public press, all these people come from the narrow class of the privileged few of South Vietnam. And the Viet Cong are taken from the larger classes, the people. And until Saigon suffers its massive popular upheaval, there will be no stability in any government that exists in Saigon. Between the day that I began to prepare this lecture and this moment, a government was overthrown, a new government was imposed, a revolution was attempted against that government, that revolution was apparently aborted. The general who was presumably the strong man of the original government was allowed to go on a long sea voyage. The game of musical chairs continues. All of our talk of strengthening responsible government in Saigon is just that talk. No official has ever been elected in this little nation since the French were pushed out in 1954. There is no popularity which can be garnered for these men. They are seen as our puppets, or worse, as holdovers from an unwanted past. What then? We need peace. The world needs peace. And apparently even the Russian, Chinese world would not be averse to some negotiation, to the dampening of the fires. Strangely, Russia was among the leading nations at the Geneva Conference in establishing that arrangement for Indochina. And according to London, Russia has already indicated her desire to convene some similar conference, to negotiate, to compromise. We need peace. The world needs peace. It would be a mad world indeed which allowed South Vietnam to be the dynamite cap which explodes the final Holocaust. I would therefore call upon the President of the United States to make clear to the American people and to the world our willingness to negotiate now, our willingness to enter into hard bargaining with all parties concerned, somehow to stabilize the area. And I would further call upon our president to inform the American people that there can be no victory in South Vietnam. We should have no illusions, and he must do it now. The more treasure we pour in, the more gold stars that are hung in mothers' windows, the more men who are wounded, the longer the situation is exacerbated, the shriller becomes the eagle's scream. Frustration leads to belligerency. Belligerency leads to erratic, purposeless, angry action. The president, if he long delays taking the nation into his confidence and speaking the truth, may find that his hands are tied, and that when he wants to negotiate, he will lack the will, the popular will, to back him up. Negotiation now can be presented to the American people as a useful, functional part of our national policy. Congress people and the like have argued this for many years. Delayed. Negotiation will only be seen as a sellout. The American people may not be willing to accept it. Are there practical political solutions to the South Vietnamese situation? There are always peaceful solutions. There is a possibility of United Nations presence. There is a possibility of the presence of the nations that were signatories to the 1954 Geneva Conference. There is the possibility of a new conference of other nations. There's even been suggestion of the neutralization of the entire area to seal out this emerging world from the passions and the tensions of the Cold War. There are always possible peaceful solutions if none of the great nations insist on their pound of flesh, and if none of the leaders of the great nations are too alarmed that they might lose too much face. I am certain that we will negotiate in South Vietnam. Maybe today, maybe begin a month from now, a year from now, a dozen years from now. The situation cries out for negotiation and political arrangement. It is the only solution. I only pray that we will attempt negotiation now, and not tardily. Now, before the dangers mount. Now, before this nation is made to suffer a more brutal suffering than it has yet known. Now, before another life is lost. Amen.